This is Geek Speak for Saturday, March 28th, 2015. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio 88.9 and KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. You know, Ben, we're not actually recording live.
No, we're not.
We're broadcasting live. We're recording this week. And we're sitting in your home. Hey, welcome to Geek Speak, bridge the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the geeks affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in his living room is Ben Jaffe, a teacher, web developer, traveler, and world music geek. Hi.
You almost said the air room, didn't you?
I did. I almost did. It is kind of the air room today.
It's a room. It has air.
But I got to say that in your home, in the restroom, you have an amazing contraption to conserve water.
We're in a drought, Lyle.
So you've got a tub on a stand next to the toilet,
yeah.
And the toilet lid is lifted, and then the tub has a drain spout that goes into the toilet. Does that actually, that whole thing function?
Yeah, it does. So the idea is when you flush the toilet, it flushes like normal. And then instead of refilling from the wall and from the city water and potable drinking water, it refills from this big basin, which is our shower water when we're heating up the shower. And it's the rainwater from the rain barrels we have outside. And the only problem is that the basin is not very high off the ground. It's only a couple feet higher than the toilet tub. And the consequence of this is that there's not much pressure, and so it refills very slowly.
Okay, I got you.
So it takes about an hour. So you flush the toilet,
yeah.
You have to wait an hour, and then you can flush the toilet again.
And that's basically because there's a spring lever that actually
has a
float on it that determines when to shut it off, and that has a hard spring,
so the water pressure
causes it to flow through, and basically you could adjust that spring, however, probably.
I think it just needs more pressure.
All right.
Yeah. I have poked around, tried to get it to work, but that's okay.
So at work this last week, everybody's been talking about South by Southwest, an amazing tech conference slash music show slash tons of things that happens down south.
I really, really want to go to that someday.
And I've wanted to go to this event.
Have you ever been? I've never been,
but I've had friends that have talked there and everything. Mm-hmm. And every year, wonderful things are talked about. So what happened this year that you found interesting?
Well, so first of all, I just wanted to introduce that, in case you didn't know about it, there is a Qualcomm Tricorder X Prize. Now, before I describe what that is, the Tricorder is this handheld device that you use in Star Trek. And it tells you
fictitious
all
of... characters use on Star Trek.
That I know. And it tells you all kinds of things, like whether the planet you're on has breathable air, which is not really a concern of us living on Earth here. And, you know, whether something is dead or alive, or whether there are any life forms nearby. So it's a really great science fiction device to advance the plot of Star Trek episodes. And quickly cut through the psychobabble.
It's also used as a medical device, right?
Yes. Yeah. There are medical tricorders. They're slightly different.
Okay.
But we won't get into that.
All right.
So the idea of the X Prize, the Qualcomm Tricorder X Prize, is that they're trying to make portable wireless devices that monitor and diagnose your health conditions. So they're basically trying to make a medical tricorder similar to what's in Star Trek.
Trying to make this, right? Because it would be really convenient to know what's going on for the a portable device.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you cut yourself, you could diagnose yourself with a portable device rather than going to the hospital.
You know, normally when you cut yourself, you know the problem.
Well, yeah. Well, is the wound infected? How about that?
Okay, good, yes.
So the idea is that we could hopefully have these.
So what is Qualcomm doing about it?
Well, Qualcomm.
Qualcomm is the modem company, right?
Qualcomm is the company that has a stadium named after it in San Diego.
Oh, okay.
Better than Petco Park, which is the other stadium there.
Stuff I didn't need to know.
Well, I grew up in San Diego. Anyway, this is a $10 million competition. So if you can build a tricorder that does the various things that the competition wants to have done, then you could win $10 million.
So they set goalposts of different things they'd want it to do, and then whoever gets the closest kind of wins the prize or partial prizes. It's a similar thing to self-driving cars, where you have competitions and the best teams kind of get some of the funding.
Yes, exactly. So at South by Southwest, Robert Call, who's the president and CEO of a company called CloudDX, I don't know where they get these names, he's standing on stage and he's unbuttoning his shirt to show them how to use this tricorder and, Yeah.
It's, what could their tricorder do?
Their tricorder... So, I actually haven't read the entire article.
Well, let me ask you this. Is the John Roddenberry Foundation a part of this? I mean, is it okay to use that term?
That I assume so.
Or just
I mean, people say warp
so
drive.
Cool, matter.
People say, you know, transporter to talk about.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, cool. Tricorders getting closer to actually working in Southwest.
Yeah.
Well, when you read that article, tell us what it did, okay?
No. Just kidding. I've got it right here.
All right,
good. So there's a base station which connects to a paired smartphone or a tablet, and that's your display.
That makes sense.
So it's not actually just a self-contained unit. You actually have to connect a smartphone or some kind of tablet up to.
But yeah, but so does the doctor. The doctor does that anyway, right?
Well,
McCoy has a little probe that pulls out of the tricorder. And then
that's what makes it a medical tricorder.
That's right.
Very good, Lau. There's also the Universal Diagnostic Stick, which is kind of an epic name. And that can actually do lab tests for things like diabetes or pneumonia or tuberculosis.
I'm assuming and that takes samples.
It actually, yeah, exactly. It actually, we haven't gotten to the point where you can just point something at someone and be like, oh, they have tuberculosis. Simple. No, so it actually draws a little bit of blood from the user's finger, puts it through a test strip, kind of similar to what doctors do in the lab. Mm-hmm. You know, when you go in for a test, the only difference is that it's portable, right?
Yeah.
And then there's also a combination scanning wand, and it's about the size of a thing of lipstick. It has a camera. It can examine skin lesions or wounds, and
it can
examine
a little microscope kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And it can examine your ear to look at your eardrum, and it can measure the amount of volume of air that you exhale. So that's called a spirometer.
That's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, in a little device.
Stuff. Yeah,
yeah, or in a couple little devices.
Yeah, now this is the thing: is there are multiple little devices, but I'm assuming they can be put into a pack or something.
You know, if you take a piece of tape and you combine them together,
well, wait,
that's
a
tricorder.
Are there three things?
There are three things.
Well,
yes.
That's tricorder. There you go.
Tricorder.
I don't know what the missing fourth, though, has always confused me.
Yeah.
Okay.
but at the same time, quadcopter is not four helicopters.
Sure, it's got four blades.
Four blades, but oh gosh, okay.
Oh my gosh, it's amazing these numbers work.
You've got me there. I just have never thought about this.
Well, you know, it's hard. Our brains don't do what we expect. I mean, take, for example, security prompts.
Oh, geez. Yes, security prompts. So have you ever had your computer pop up a little prompt and say like, hey, do you want to allow this, you know, xyz.dll to run or whatever?
I'm not on a Windows machine anymore, but yeah, I know what you mean. And Mac does it too. Just
yeah.
Not DLL.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Absolutely. So like these little prompts that say, do you want to do this? And we kind of go yes or no. And of course, if we say no, we know things that we want to have happen will not happen. So we're kind of inclined to say yes.
Yeah. So you just click OK.
Even if you don't understand what it was.
So it's kind of like the terms and conditions, right? The terms and conditions or terms of service or terms of use, they pop up. You've got this teeny, teeny little place where you can read and the scroll bar is infinitesimal and you can click and drag it and you can't read anything. They expect you to press OK. And then legally
you're bound. You know what I used to do on those? Especially when they're web forms?
Copy and paste them?
I would simply modify the raw HTML in browser and then approve that one. Say yes to that. Or disable the forced accept and just say no, and then it would move forward. And of course, do a screen capture beforehand. I used to do that for years. I would modify the thing so that I wasn't accepting it. And the thing is, if you give me a contract and I make a note and modify the contract and then I sign that modification... Well, that's what I'm accepting. Not
that's a
the
really
original.
Smart idea. So basically, what you're saying is the prompt comes up on your bank website or on your whatever website, and says press accept. You accept to the following,
mm-hmm.
And then
modify
you just right click inspect element.
Yeah,
delete all that text.
No,
replace.
I normally would
else.
Say accept where I find it inappropriate.
Oh, you just add that to the end.
Yeah.
Oh,
no, Chris,
hey.
This doesn't stand up in court at all. It was when I was young and full of ideas. Now I just blindly accept it and a little bit of my soul goes away.
Right.
So
yeah.
Anyway, people, these things work because people just say yes all the time. I mean, what's the security concern?
So the security issue is if your computer pops up and says, hey, do you want to allow xyz.dll or .whatever to run? Mm-hmm. Basically, it's saying, do you, Lyle, trust this program? And if you press OK, your computer will actually trust it because Lyle told me to do so.
Yes, right. It's basically that one step where it's an application wants to run. The computer's not sure if you actually intend to run it. It could be malware of some sort.
Yeah.
So it asks you.
So it trusts your judgment.
Which is silly because, of course, how would we know if it's okay?
Right. So, and the idea, of course, is if some software that you do recognize is trying to run, then you know you're running it, right?
Right.
You're saying, I want to launch whatever.
If you just double clicked on something and then it asks you, do you want to run it? You're like, mm-hmm. Yeah, I just double clicked it.
Now, if something pops up just completely out of nowhere and says, do you want blah, blah, blah to run?
I would say no.
You would say no.
Well,
I would say no. Probably. It could be some internal process or something like that. We would probably be a little suspicious. But as it turns out, they put some people in an MRI machine.
Mm-hmm.
And they looked at what people's brains did.
With these silly prompts?
When these prompts come
up.
So the security warning pops up. And, people click OK. They kind of read it. They kind of pay a little attention.
I'm assuming in this study, they didn't know that that was actually part of it, right? They were just kind of...
Yeah. They're just like, OK, I don't know why you're putting me in a weird machine, but sure, I'll do whatever you say. And then another prompt comes up. And the person pays less attention to it because of habituation.
Yeah.
You habituate to
the norm.
Yeah, exactly. Another thing pops up and you even pay less attention to it, right? And as this keeps happening, you just get completely desensitized to these security warnings.
As we all do.
Yeah, absolutely. So the difficult thing is, what do you do about this? Because it's really, really important for the computer to be able to ask, hey, owner of this computer, is this okay?
Right.
Or is this not okay?
Well, I would say it's kind of a fault of the entire system that they have to ask the user that. Because you don't really know what the code is. You might know the name of it or the location
right.
on your hard drive, but you don't really know what it's running. So asking that's kind of, I mean, why
yeah.
ask?
So I can see situations in which it would be really difficult for a system to get around this, for
yes.
a system to know what to do.
Well, when you install or download something new, that's a perfect example.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
It doesn't know for the first time, so it tells you where it came from and says, is that appropriate?
Yeah, it doesn't
that
know if
definitely
you just,
should be asked by the user.
It doesn't know if you just clicked on a link on a phishing email or something like
right.
that and some malicious application is being downloaded. So in some cases, it makes a lot of sense for mm-hmm. the computer to ask.
I agree.
But in trying to figure out what to do about this to make people pay more attention, there have been a couple of theories. One is make the security warnings look a little different every single time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then
put the button in different spots.
Exactly. Then people won't acclimate to it.
I've also seen a situation where the button is grayed out for a while, and you have to wait for a while before the button is available to
click.
Yeah,
Chrome does that a lot.
Uh-huh.
Like if you're installing a Chrome extension. By the way, if you install a Chrome extension, make sure you know what you're installing, because Chrome extensions get updated automatically, and they could start doing things maliciously when they weren't
As a Chrome plugin developer, you know this. Extension, excuse
I
me.
I do know this, yeah. I don't know
well,
why.
You know, the one that I like the most on asking a person has to do with deleting a GitHub repo. Now, GitHub source control, it's open source platform, basically. It's a commercial environment where you can upload applications and code and share it publicly. So
for example, the GeekSpeak website. Right.
GeekSpeak.org is under my handle on GitHub is Lyle, and under that is GeekSpeak.org. And that's entire source code, minus the secrets of how the GeekSpeak website works.
And I have a copy of that
right,
as well.
Right.
On
fork
my,
of that.
Yeah, on Ben Jaffe.
And so let's say I built a project and I wanted to delete it, right? And let's say at some point, I don't know, I want to delete something that I don't use anymore.
Yeah.
So I go up there and I say, delete this repo. And GitHub says, are you sure? Which is a good thing to do, right?
Right.
But instead of saying, are you sure to delete
this? Yes, no.
It doesn't say yes, no. It says, please type the name of the repo that you want to delete.
Mm.
And it tells you what the name is, but you have to retype it personally. You can't even copy it there. It doesn't lie to copy from there. You've got to type it in. And then you say delete, which is great because you're spending time to read it, which
So it's basically saying you want to kill this repo. First, you have to say its name one more
That's
time.
Right. Say its name. And of course, that would make sense on a security prompt of, are you sure you want to run this DLL scarything.dll? And then if you do, you have to type scarything.dll run and then hit enter. And then it would stop people from doing it.
Yeah.
Of course, it'd be really irritating.
It's funny you bring up GitHub. Mm. I have actually gotten to that prompt, started typing the name, and then thought,
that's not the right name.
Am I really sure I want to delete this repo? Maybe I'll go back.
It works.
So one of the issues with making these security prompts change every single time or every other time or something like that is that then people will habituate to the warnings changing. And so if anything in the warning changes, if any of the text in the warning changes, people won't notice it because they're used to warnings that always look different, right? So that kind of shoots down that idea, I guess. The ideal, of course, as you already brought up, is for the computer to generally know this a little bit better, know what's a good thing to do, what's a bad thing to do. And then it can ask the user only when it's really, really, when it really needs to know. You know, it has no idea.
Yeah, definitely. Hey, let's talk about launch facilities, abandoned launch facilities in space launches.
Yeah, that sounds
and
good.
Also, let's do some corrections about birds and flight and windmills. We'll be right back here on Geek Speak. This is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm speaking with Ben Jaffe in his living room. You can hear the sound difference. It's nice and personal today. Hey, if you want to participate in any show of Geek Speak, you're welcome to do so by letting us know on Geek Speak on Twitter. KOSP Geeks is our handle on Twitter. And actually, I think KOSP Geeks is also our handle on Facebook. So find us on those media platforms. Say hi, comment on the show, share things, and all those wonderful things. And of course, we love a recommendation on iTunes to help spread the word. Only recommend the show if you like it. If not, don't rate us at all, please.
Right.
So Ben, what's
and, yeah. and actually when you write on Facebook, we all get it.
Yeah.
We all see it.
It's really cool.
Yeah.
Hey, what's going on with abandoned launch facilities? What do you mean space launching, right?
I mean space launching, and what's going on with them? Nothing.
They're
abandoned.
Exactly. Good story, Ben. Good story.
So moving on. No. No, actually,
Let's talk about abandoned trees. You don't have to know.
There is not really a story with these abandoned launch facilities, but there are some pretty, pretty pictures. And these are actually from this guy, Roland Miller's upcoming book called Abandoned in Place. It's called Abandoned Space Graveyard Photos, Abandoned in Place. And it's just a bunch of pictures of deactivated launch and research facilities. And it's kind of neat, you know.
Are they done with high dynamic range, sir?
They don't look like it to me.
Let me see.
They just look like normal photos. What do you think, Lau?
Normal photo.
Yep, that's a normal photo. This is a normal. Yeah, this is a really good episode.
In fact, you know, those pictures, very cool. I like the idea of going and finding different locations that have been abandoned. I'm assuming they're test facilities, not just like Cape Canaveral, of course, because mostly those things are not abandoned. That first thing you showed me was a lattice with a ship on it, looks like, right?
Yeah.
Wow. So it's just sitting there, ready to go?
As far as I know.
Ooh, and inside of facilities too. Cool.
Yeah. So
you'll have to check these up at geekspeak.org.
Space things photo galleries a lot. So this is one.
All right. Okay. A couple weeks ago, we had a wonderful episode on actually March 14th. The title of the show was Siri Gets an Alternative Lift to Pi Energy. You can hear all about everything we talked about. One of the things we talked about was about windmill technology. And at one point, there was discussion a bit about windmill technology, whether it's dangerous for birds. And I flippantly made a remark. And epotter95, I believe, contacted us on Twitter and said, hey, I just heard the comment on your program about the hazard windmills pose to birds. One of your commenters dismissed the problem, saying that it is dwarfed by the number of birds taken by domestic cats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember you said that.
That was my flippant remark.
And I felt sad for the birds.
Yeah.
And then we moved on.
Yeah, we moved on. And I didn't cover the story very well. So there you go. No, I wanted to cover a little bit more. I wanted to cover a little bit more because I thought...
That was the story.
We should have some follow-up. I mean,
yeah.
It is true that birds kill a lot more than...
Cats kill a lot more birds
than windmills. And here's some stats on that. So... Feral domestic cats kill hundreds of millions of birds a year. Power lines, 130 million to 174 million. Windows, just residential clear glass, 100 million to a billion per year.
Oh,
pesticides, 70 million per year.
That's crazy.
Automobiles, 60 to 80 million a year. Lighted communications towers, 40 million to 50 million. And wind turbines, 10,000 to 40,000. So we're talking a lot less.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the whole story, and that's specifically why epotter95 said to me, you're not covering it well, because one of the issues is that some of these windmills are in the flights of birds of prey, large creatures that get killed.
Migratory birds.
In fact, about 573,000 birds each year are killed in the United States with regards, the Associated Press estimates, with windmills. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so it's a little higher than some of the other numbers you hear, and the numbers go back and forth. Now, these numbers, though, were calculated and figured out by looking at some numbers on the very first windmills in set up in the United States. Do you know where the first windmills were set up in the United States? Do you know of any windmill farms?
Yeah, well, I know of some. They're off of Highway 10.
You're thinking of probably... Oh, are you thinking down in Los Angeles?
I'm thinking down just east of LA. Yeah.
Okay, I'm thinking those are here really beautiful when you drive by near Oakland and in that area. The Ultimate Pass is a very famous windmill farm.
Yeah, I've driven through there too.
Yeah. In fact, the... Oh, by the way, of these hundreds of thousands of birds that are killed every year, about 10% are prey, likely raptors,
birds of prey,
which are, you know, normally endangered.
Yeah.
And so in any case, the Ultimate Pass is a unique case it's one of the earliest windmill farms in the U.S., which is kind of interesting. It also has an older, by mass, older windmills,
okay.
So earlier designs.
So not whatever ones we came up after research and development and iteration.
The early ones, yeah. There's about 4,000 wind turbines at the Ultimate Pass Energy Farm in California. And what's interesting is that like 20-year-old turbines are really out of date, but they're still functioning, some of them. They have a smaller surface area. They spin a lot faster. The earlier ones had actually a lattice framework, kind of like that launch facility you showed, with a lot of grid places, lots of places to land if you were a bird.
Mm-hmm.
And the theory was that birds of prey were landing on these structures because they're high up. And then, of course, flying around and landing on them, they'd get hit by these high-speed turbines.
Mm, I see.
And these turbines, they're traveling about 80 meters per second or 179 miles an hour. Like, these are not slow-spinning things. These are fast.
Don't we have turbines that are slower than that now?
Yeah, but 20 years ago, we didn't. So the numbers okay. The numbers that make up all this death of raptors and everything has to do with Ultimate Pass. Because people were collecting information from there. The turbine structures that were lattice works where people land on them, the high-speed, low-surface area turbines, those were accounting for these large numbers of counts, so the 500,000 counts and 10% raptors. So when it comes down to looking at them, and there's been a lot of work in this area and trying to make turbines better. Now, the structure actually attracts large birds, right? And so what you might want to do, instead of having a lattice structure where you have lots of perch points, is just have a giant monopole. So that's the new designs. They have giant monopoles with the idea that, well, the birds won't have a place to land, therefore they won't be as attracted to being there. That doesn't do it everything, though. The National Geographic has a great article linked to from geekspeak.org, published in April of last year. And I'll just quote from that. The larger, more efficient structures appear to kill more birds per turbine than the windmills they're replacing, between 3 and 8 birds per turbine per year, according to the LOSS. Despite assertions that these turbines would reduce mortality rates, cumulatively, they could still be responsible for a lot of mortality, says the author of this study. So basically, even though they thought they'd be able to make the poles and therefore less birds, they're killing more birds. So this is definitely a problem. And the biggest reason for this emergence of especially Ultimate Pass has to do with flight migration. They happen to be in the way of where birds want to fly.
I see.
And birds don't always want to fly everywhere, right? There's certain areas. It's a pass for a reason, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a low point, and so birds fly through there. And so the basically the correct way to go about this is to incentivize wind farms to be placed such that they don't take out birds.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what we're seeing. There's the federal rules regulating the permits. Basically, wind farms would now get permits for a certain amount of eagles they can kill every year, or birds of prey they can kill every year, and they have to stay below that number. If they work hard, they can keep going if they work hard to reduce the count. So this is definitely still a problem with
windmills.
That's
really...
It's not... My flippant response was completely stupid, and I just want to correct that, and I really appreciate the feedback from E. Porter 95, whoever that is, on correcting a bit about this. It's a serious problem. There are windmill designs with lights on them, with buzzing sounds. All these are features to try to reduce the amount of bird fatalities.
Yeah, that's a really strange metric, though, to say that, you know, you're allotted a certain number of birds per year. It's really strange.
Yeah, the National Audubon Society didn't like it very much.
Right.
They said Auburn the Audubon strongly supports properly sighted wind power. the basically saying that people should be aware of the issue so people can judge the affordance of wind power. Mm-hmm. Highly questionable conservation value. And they called the department's assurances that there would be 5-year inspections to police the rule bureaucratic vapor. They basically don't think that this whole idea of permitting people to kill a certain amount of birds is actually going to work out very well.
I see. Okay. Yeah.
So Spain has had some success with wind energy companies that shut down the farms during periods of time when migration occurs, which makes a lot of sense. If you know your birds are going to migrate. I don't think birds of prey migrate en masse, so it doesn't really work. But like geese formations, mm-hmm. you could shut them down during the migratory area. And of course, they've got UV lamps, spinning blades that actually light up the blades themselves, so lit, high contrast colors, lots of innovation. And we're just not in the magic spot where we're reducing the bird deaths, unfortunately.
That's a bummer.
Yeah.
That's a big bummer for the birds. So my hope is that either technology can solve this problem or smarter placement can solve this problem.
It definitely seems like we're not going to abandon the windmills. We're going to try to figure out a way to make this work.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that we'll get better tech along the way.
Yeah,
if you see any stories on, we'll definitely cover any stories on windmills that don't kill birds specifically.
Yes, send those in.
All right. So we talked about abandoned launch facilities. We talked about some corrections from our show.
I want to talk about browsers.
Please do.
Because you and I spend a lot of time in browsers.
Considering we're both web developers, yeah.
We're both web developers, so we pretty much spend all of our time at work in browsers. And if we're not working on our applications, we are reading Gmail or looking up starts for Geekspeak.
A browser is a World Wide Web browser. That's where it came
World
from.
Wide Web? I haven't World heard Wide that
web,
term
remember?
In months.
And of course, Chrome is the one that we use a lot because it's got great development tools built into it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Anybody can actually launch them and see how the website works. And of course, Safari on a Macintosh is the most popular. Internet Explorer on Windows is most popular. And then Firefox is the lone wolf, awesome nonprofit.
Well, the lone wolf is Opera because at least in the States, no one ever brings up Opera.
All right.
Even though they do really cool things.
So what about browsers?
So every year there is a sponsored hacking challenge called Pwn to Own. And Pwn
with
is spelled
P-W-N,
the number 2, O-W-N. It's a very elite hacker spelling speak.
Elite, of course, is an abbreviation of elite. That's where that elite came from. And it's almost spelled 7-E-E-T. But let's go on. So what is Pwn to Own for browsers?
Pwn to Own, the Pwn to Own conference is basically, it's a hacking challenge conference where a bunch of people who think that they can find vulnerabilities in these browsers go and they try and exploit these browsers and find ways to either escalate privileges in ways that they shouldn't or, you know, in some other way get around any of the walls and fences that the browsers put to keep people out.
Gotcha. In fact, one of the things we say when you get an email, don't click on that link because you don't know where the email came from. You might go to a website that's taken advantage of some of these vulnerabilities in the browser and then own your machine. The website could own your machine. So this whole conference is about talking about and exploring the ways of doing that, which of course allows us to build better browsers too.
Yeah, and actually if you do find a vulnerability, then you get in the tens of thousands of dollars for this. You actually have, there's a monetary reward.
An invulnerability that no one else has found. Or
yes, specifically.
First one to recommend. Or
specifically,
first,
yeah. This is wonderful for the browser makers because the browser makers basically get for relatively cheap, you know, $15,000, $20,000, $40,000, they basically are told about a vulnerability in their software and then they can go fix it before some evil person does.
Hardening their system. Yes.
Hardening their system. Yeah, that's the process of making your system more invulnerable to vulnerabilities.
I like you said more invulnerable because the truth is even after these hackathons and they figure out exactly how to pwn a machine and then the browser fixes them, there's still more vulnerabilities. There's always more vulnerabilities.
Now, here's a metaphor for software and security. Or actually, maybe it's not a metaphor. Maybe it says something. Anyway.
You say it and I'll judge it.
Right. So you have a house, right?
I have a house.
I have a house as well.
I rent a house.
Have you ever had an ant problem?
Yes.
Okay. So what's the solution to ant problems typically?
You know, actually poisoning is probably one of the best solutions for ant problems.
Right. So you that's basically finding a way to get the ants to take poison back to the nest and all that. That doesn't work with hackers because a hacker goes into your system, does something bad, and then gets out.
So caulking, I think people sometimes try caulking things.
Putting stuff in all of the potential places that ants might crawl into your house. But your house has a lot of surface area.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of different places that ants could crawl in. And some of those are places that you might find, like, for example, a window that's cracked or something, or yeah, not sealing properly. Or it might be some hole in a wall and then through another hole behind your couch or something.
Or behind your cabinets where your dishes are, right? It's in the hole in the wall behind the cabinets. I mean, how do you get to that?
You don't. Yeah. You can't, right? These are things that are not at all evident. So
you could also have carpenter ants, by the way, which I have, which actually live in the house, in the wood of the house. So what do you get to do with those? You've got to tarp the whole thing. Poison.
No idea, right?
And the reason I said poison instead of caulking is that I've seen people try to stop ants by blockading them. They're very persistent little things.
It doesn't work.
Keep going. No, they don't.
Yeah, they'll just keep going and eventually they'll find a little hole. So that's one good way of thinking about security and thinking about hackers is if they are attacking a system, they will just keep hitting that system from all the different possible ways. And the system isn't attacking back. The system's just trying to defend itself, right? So this competition at this conference is basically a way for browser makers to say, hey, you guys, come at me with the best you got.
Yeah,
right?
That's cool.
And also, in the past, there haven't been as many vulnerabilities found as there were this year. As browsers are getting more and more secure, they're actually finding more and more things because their methods become more and more novel.
Mm.
So rather than just attacking the front gate and maybe sometimes getting through, now the front gate is totally secure. So maybe they try climbing over the side fence or, you know, that kind of thing.
In fact, you also see as the web technologies get more complicated, you see different type of exploits, like loading web fonts and then being able to exploit a font loaded remotely through SVG scripting or something. Like there's side channels that don't feel like the standard part of the browser, but of course the browser is a pretty complicated system. So
yeah, so like
little
you go
tiny
to a
cracks
website
everywhere.
And it loads a custom font, and all of a sudden you're compromised. How does that work? You know.
Yeah.
So basically, my point is, software is so complicated. In fact, many people would say, and I think I would agree, that software, generally speaking, it can often be the most complicated systems that humans have built.
Yes.
You know,
I said that to someone recently, and they looked at me like, "You're a developer."
It's true.
I feel that way, but then again, we're both engineers, software engineers.
So. When you go to a website, the number of things that have to happen in the right way, in the right order, it's just mind-boggling. And you know, it's the kind of number of things that not one single person could ever know.
You know, one of the statements I love in I watch The Big Bang Theory. And Sheldon Cooper, have you ever watched the show?
Yeah.
Okay. He was once called a rocket scientist as a compliment. He took it as an insult because he's a theoretical physicist, and theoretical physics is a lot more complicated
than rocket science. It's a lot harder.
And I would say software engineering can be more complicated than rocket science.
It can
but
be, absolutely.
Then again, I feel like we're just tooting our own horns because we're software engineers. Hey, so by the way, is there one more thing?
Yeah, one more thing, which is that the software that was exploited. Attacked and exploited successfully. Adobe Flash, Adobe Reader, IE11, that's Microsoft's web browser, and Firefox on the first day of the Pwn2Own event. And that, in total, $317,500 were awarded to the people for the first day. Second day, which was March 19th, of the challenge, people managed to exploit Firefox again, Internet Explorer again, Google Chrome, and Apple Safari. So at this point, pretty much every browser.
Yeah, every browser matters talking about. Opera wasn't.
That's why I said pretty much.
So
because I feel bad for Opera.
So it's good that these events happen. And by the way, the ant discussion was a metaphor. Congratulations. Yeah, you won a prize. You asked earlier if it was going to be a metaphor.
I always get those confused. I really should spend some time on Wikipedia.
Depends on your phrasing, basically. Hey, in just a second, we'll be back. We're going to talk about, are people evil or stupid? That's a good question, don't you think? This is Geek Speak. You're listening to Ben Jaffe and Lyle Troxel. We'll be right back. You're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Lyle Troxel, and Ben Jaffe's with me. In a second, we're going to talk about whether people are stupid or smart or evil. But first, you weren't really done with browser crashing and browser pwning, were you?
Yeah. So I was talking about Pwn2Own, the competition conference thing. There's one other thing that came out, which is the developer discovered a hack in Google Chrome which can crash the Chrome tab. And you think, okay, well, you know, you're crashing the Chrome tab. So is that a problem? You know, it's not really a security vulnerability. I mean, it is making Chrome do something that you're not supposed to be able to make it do. But basically, if you put a special 13 character string in your website, this is 13 character
what is
string.
It? Can you read all the characters?
Written in Assyrian.
It has been a foreign, different language.
Huh? What is Assyrian? Well, Assyria is an ethnic group indigenous to Mesopotamia, and I don't know anything more about them than that.
But the UTC code of some sort, something does something.
It's
odd.
A beautiful looking language. But
you can't look at it in Chrome, though.
It says, ha ha, your browser has crashed. No, it only works on the Mac, and it only works in Google Chrome. And this particular website, I'm looking at an image of it because I'm using Chrome.
Right.
So I don't want to, you know, I don't want to see this. This is, so I'm looking at an image, JPEG of it, and you can click on this particular link. I'm not going to click on it because it'll crash my Chrome browser. It's been reported to Google. It's been marked as a duplicate, so they're
it'll
probably already working
really
on
soon.
It. You know,
yeah,
but I mean, you know, this just reiterates
yes.
what I was saying earlier about how ridiculously complicated browsers and software is. Like, this doesn't make any sense. Actually, a bug that a friend of mine found was one particular version of Chrome. This is a year ago or so. If you didn't have DevTools open, in certain circumstances, every letter on the web page would be shifted to the left. So B's would become A's and C's would become B's.
Oh, cool.
And then you open up the DevTools and the problem goes away.
Awesome.
So you have no way of debugging this thing.
That's great.
And they were just like, what do we do about this bug? This is impossible.
That's awesome.
Like, why would this, how can this happen? Okay, you were going to talk about something really interesting.
Yeah, so I wanted to tell you, do you know what an adage is?
Yeah.
Just a general kind of
It makes me think of a fable, Aesop's
yeah.
Fables, but an adage, it's like a moral of the story kind of thing, right?
It's funny because I was talking about this thing I'm about to talk about, and I said it's a cool adage, and someone's like, what's an adage? I'm like, it's a... I tried to explain it. It's like, oh, it's I don't know the definition. So,
and then you put me on the spot.
Yeah,
thank
no,
you.
That's what I did it for you.
You're so kind.
No, an adage, as Wikipedia says, is a short, usually philosophical, but memorable saying which holds some important fact of experience that is considered true by many people or that has gained some credibility through its long mimetic usage.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
I knew you were going to say
you're
that.
You're cheating. You have Wikipedia open and you asked me what it is. Okay.
I'm sorry. I thought you'd kind of actually have it because... I stumbled through it and kind
all right,
of
all right, so what's an example
the
of
example
an
that I want to talk about is Hanlon's Razor. Hanlon's Razor. Do you know this one specifically?
I know Occam's Razor.
Okay.
I don't know
what,
Hanlon's Razor.
Do you know Occam's Razor?
Oh, yes. It's paraphrased, it's if there's a simpler explanation and a more complicated explanation, go with a simpler one. So
yes.
if you see something in the sky and it could have been a slow-moving cloud or a UFO, probably was a cloud.
Right. And this is used in science a lot, actually. It's a generally kind of reduced to take the simplest of two answers, right?
Right.
Take the simplest of two. And the thing is that's kind of difficult about that is if you want to say, well, how does the sun actually work? You have to describe all these physics around it. Or you could say, oh, God makes it work. So you could say with Occam's Razor that God making it work is actually simpler, right? But that's not really the idea behind it. It's
yeah.
much more like you know a whole bunch of information, and given the information you know, like you can test and see and everything, what's the simplest solution that kind of fits?
Exactly.
Okay, so Hanlon's Razor is very similar to that kind of idea, but Hanlon's Razor is a saying, here it is, never attribute to malice which is adequately explained by stupidity.
So if someone wrongs you in your workplace,
yes.
you can be like, oh, I hate them. They're so malicious. Or you can be like, maybe they're just either stupid or incompetent or they didn't have all the information and so they acted poorly because of that.
Yeah. So I posted this on Twitter or Facebook or something a couple weeks ago. And then during the last couple weeks, it keeps on coming up. Sometimes somebody else mentions it. Sometimes I gave it as advice.
Oh, you just
to somebody.
Keep hearing about it.
I keep on hearing about it. And I think it is a very telling thing that it is easy. It is really easy to think people are doing you wrong.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just as easy to think that people are not paying attention or they're just being ignorant. You know, it does say stupid in this, you know, never attribute to malice which is adequately explained by stupidity. But it doesn't have to be stupidity. It can be lack of knowledge, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Unawareness,
yeah.
right? I might have wronged you by interrupting you at one point. I didn't do it intentionally.
Wait, Lau, what was that?
Exactly. So in any point, I just want everyone to kind of take that in. Most of the time, people are just being stupid. They're not being malicious. So there you go. There's my sage adage for this week. All right.
Very nice.
What's going on with Mars, Ben?
Mars. God, they really messed this up. They're so stupid. No, I'm kidding. They didn't mess anything up. In fact, they now...
Who's they?
So this is the Mars Science Laboratory. Mm-hmm. In 2012, we landed half a ton on Mars, half a ton of weight on Mars. This is the rover Curiosity, which is rolling around, taking pictures, doing all kinds of stuff. It has finished taking, and we have now stitched together, the first ever 1 billion picture mosaic from the surface of Mars.
Whoa, from its level?
Its view.
Cool.
So it's this, it's absolutely beautiful. And so I saw a smaller picture of this. I didn't see the entire thing. So I just clicked on it.
So this is, it's taking a picture, and then it takes another picture, and it takes another picture, and then we, with software,
stitch them all together
to make a very high quality picture.
Yeah, and I'm showing it to you now. I loaded it up, and there's this nice small version up at the top. It looks fairly normal. But if you scroll down, there's all of it. And just keep scrolling and scrolling and scrolling.
It's massive, everybody.
It's this.
Ben, this is radio.
Phenomenally huge image. And it's just, it's crazy. So when you look up in the night sky and you're like, wow, it's Mars. And then your friend says, no, that's a star. That's Mars. And you're like, oh, wow, that's Mars. Like,
yeah.
This is, it's so far away. You can't tell if it's a star or a planet.
It's kind of reddish.
And we have a little rolling creature on its surface taking pictures. This is crazy. It is
interesting. When,
it's mind-boggling.
When you scroll that image by, it's kind of, it's a landscape shot stitched together, but it's applied on the website vertical. So you scroll
it's sideways.
The page. Yeah. And as you
turn
scroll
your
that,
head sideways.
Gosh, that's a lot. It would take me a while to really look at that picture, right? It's a lot of information. But we're talking about extremely small footprint, like little tiny, tiny thing on a planet far away. And the complexity that obviously is part of that planet is immense.
I mean, we can't get a website to render sometimes, you know? And like these people landed...
Man, rocket scientists, huh?
Oh my gosh, it's insane. It really is... I don't think about it too often. I think I may think about it more than most people because I really like space. But when I stop and think about it, that is phenomenal that we did that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Hey, last week on the 14th, we had on our show, it was called Tesla S Interviews at Uber. You'd have to listen to it to understand that. We had Greg Merkley, and he's a Canadian who has been naming our shows. In fact, he named Tesla S Interviews at Uber and most of our crazy titles for years. He just kind of found us.
He's our Canadian correspondent.
Yeah, he sent us emails. Finally, he came to California, and we had him on. And one of the web extras he never got around to is this wonderful TED Talk by Joe Desmond. About 3D printing being really, really fast. Normally 3D printing, if it looks fast, it's because it's sped up. You know,
right. Yeah. I've seen those videos where you see this 3D thing just somehow appear. And
so there's two
100x.
There's two forms of printing, right? One is you're kind of squirting out hot liquid that cools quickly, and you basically paint. Imagine trying to build something with a tube of toothpaste, right? You build it, and then as it dries, you can build another layer, and pretty soon you can have like a building. Right.
Yeah. Toothpaste is a really bad example. Maybe hot glue.
Toothpaste will harden over a day normally.
And over a day.
Yes. Yeah, so
that's really slow 3D.
Talking about slow DPI. Right. Yeah, exactly.
right. Sure.
But the other way is actually you get a substrate of material like plaster of Paris, and then you print with an inkjet printer one page, if you will. Then you add another layer and you print another page. Mm-hmm. And wherever the ink actually hits, that gets hardened. And therefore, later when you blow it free, only the places that it printed. But you know how fast a printer is, an inkjet printer is to print a page. Mm-hmm. Imagine you need 300 of those to make a 1-inch object high, right? It mm-hmm. takes a long time.
I actually, brief interlude.
Yeah, please.
I happen to know how long it takes with an inkjet printer to print 300 pages. Because when I was maybe 10 or 15, I was pretty young. We had a 14.4K modem, and I decided, because I was learning about the endangered species list in school, that I was going to print the entire thing. And so it took me 10, 15 minutes to download this really long text file, maybe 5 in the morning, and I started printing it, and it just printed and printed and print it and print it. An hour and a half later, my dad wakes up and he's like, Ben, what are you doing? You're wasting all of this ink. Oh my God. And I'd gone through basically a ream of paper. It took a really long time to print 300 pages.
It did?
That's my story.
All right. So this printer does something completely different. It has a glass.
So it doesn't work that way.
Well, right.
Okay.
It's a little faster. Well, okay. I mean, the TED Talk's all about this. You should just watch the TED Talk. It's great. We'll be up at geekspeak.org. But the way it's actually working is it has laser on the bottom of a piece of glass. And on top of the glass is a liquid. And there's a substrate that's really close to the bottom of the glass. Mm-hmm. And the laser burns the material from below, and it pulls it out of the goop, which is cool because you don't have the pixelated ridges that you normally have.
Oh, wow.
So anyway, we'll have the web extra up.
That is really cool.
Joe Desmond on TED Talks. Okay, Ben, another one for you. Let's talk about smart lock, shall we?
Oh, yeah. So this is kind of a neat idea.
I was kind of curious about this because it doesn't seem like it would make a lot of sense. So please explain.
Yeah. So basically, Google released this new Android update with this feature called Smart Lock. They didn't make a big deal out of it, but it's kind of neat. And it's something that I've actually thought of before, which is my phone should know when I'm holding it or when it's in my pocket versus when it's sitting on a table, right? So if my phone is sitting on a table, maybe someone might go and grab it, right? If the phone is in my pocket, it's very likely someone's going to steal it from my pocket or if it's in my hand. Not impossible, right. Which is one of the potential problems but
why would it be useful for your computer, for your phone to know if it's in your pocket, in your hand, or on the desk?
Because
why would that help?
If my phone is in my pocket and I'm walking around with it, when I pull my phone out of my pocket to turn it on to check my email or whatever, I have to type in my password every single time.
Right.
But if it knows, I'm still possessed by Ben. Ben is still holding me.
Oh, so Ben unlocked me. Somebody unlocked me, and then I was put in a pocket. Then I was pulled back out of the pocket. I should still be unlocked.
I'm just going to stay unlocked because I'm still the same person is holding me.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a neat idea, actually. So
that's what this feature is. The Android Smart Lock is the idea that it only locks if it goes on the table.
Exactly. It locks
if
it's...
How does it know if it's in a pocket or on the table?
Well, if it's in a pocket, it's going to be moving ever so slightly, fairly frequently.
Okay, you're saying.
If it's on a table, it's not going to be moving. Very rarely do people pick up tables and walk around with them, right? So generally, you can assume that tables are flat.
And even if you're sitting still, you do move a bit, right? You have heartbeat and all that. Do. Okay, I guess I see that. So this wouldn't work if you're on a train. Because then you put it on the table and it still moves.
No, this would not work on a train or airplane or a car.
It's gyro-based.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it detects, or accelerometer-based, I should say. It detects movement.
Does it have a machine learning capability where you, Ben, and me, Lyle, have different types of qualities of movement and everything? So in our lives, the way we move around over time, it kind of understands, this is still Ben. Oh, no, this is no longer Ben.
I can't answer your question, but I can say that if any technology could do that, it would be machine learning.
Yes.
Machine learning is an amazing, amazing tool.
As you say every week.
For taking massive amounts of data and distilling them down to a smaller amount of data.
Okay, I think we have time for one more on this show today. Yeah. So why don't we talk about GoDaddy?
Oh, first I just want to say, I have a Pebble watch.
Watch, yeah.
Right? And so whenever my phone can see my Pebble watch and is connected to my Pebble watch, it stays unlocked.
Oh.
So I already have a similar thing like this. It's just not movement-based. It's based on proximity to my smartwatch.
And when we say locked, all it does is it forces you to put a PIN code if you don't wear your Android phone.
Yeah.
If you don't wear your Pebble, for example.
So I can just say that not having to type in my password over and over again, so nice.
This is why I want the Apple Watch.
Mm, yeah. So this is just kind of a brief story, actually. I'm just going to tell you the basics of it. And then if you're interested, you can read. It's actually a 3-page article about GoDaddy accounts being vulnerable to social engineering in Photoshop is the headline.
I believe it.
And basically what it is if someone really wants to compromise your GoDaddy account, and GoDaddy is where you might have your domain registered. If I had benjaffe.com, I might have it registered there. Actually, I like other companies much more than GoDaddy.
In fact, we've over the years recommended you don't go with GoDaddy because of their advertising practices.
Yes.
Pretty sexist.
They're still huge.
Yes, they're a massive company. So yeah. GoDaddy, basically, you can buy a domain, you register with them, and then they can. But you have to have an account, and when you log in with that account, you can do things with that domain. So what's the vulnerability?
So if you really want to take over my domains, one thing you could do is you could call up GoDaddy and be like, hey, I forgot my password. I forgot my password, my login information, and all this stuff. My name is blah, blah, blah. and a GoDaddy representative would help you with that. The incentives are such that the GoDaddy representative wants to make sure you're happy.
As a customer.
Not concerned frustrated. Or frustrated or irate or whatever.
And even though you should have kept your password, you might have lost it. And
you might have actually
lost it. You'd be an unhappy customer.
Oh, yeah.
So how do they solve this problem?
So what they actually have a whole system and way of doing this, which is simply they talk to you. They try and get information. If you don't have any of the information, then they ask you questions. And if you're convincing enough, basically, in being a busy businessman or something like that, or your kid is hanging off of you while you're trying to have this phone call, well, their incentive is just to move through the process. They'll also, at least in this case, they asked for a ID, scan of a driver's license or something like that. So this guy, his personal account at GoDaddy was compromised, not by some nefarious person, but by a security researcher. So the security researcher was trying to see, hey, how good are GoDaddy's?
Oh, and they just faked like a driver's license scan,
yeah,
right? Because all you had to
they
do
spent
is
a couple hours
some
in Photoshop.
Right. It'd be easy to do.
They found a friend in Michigan or Minnesota or something like that where the driver's license was allegedly supposed to be from, got the copy of that, and changed the picture.
Easy to do. All right. Hey,
Geeks, easy peasy.
Ben Jaffe is with me in the air, and we're closing up the show. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is issued with permission. And GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, which means you can use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know where you got it, where we are. And we, of course, are at geekspeak.org all the time. And we're also at geeks@geekspeak.org if you'd like to send us email. And on Twitter and Facebook, we're KOSP Geeks. Our theme is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the air room was Mr. Ben Jaffe, and of course, not the air room, but his humble abode. Do let us know what you think of today's show. It's a slightly different format. We're not in the public space, but I thought you'd like to know what it is. This is March 28th, 2015, episode of Geek Speak. Thanks for being here.